Back to Dr. LaPree's evidence. Are there any housekeeping matters to raise or address? No, thank you. Dr. LaPree, you'll recall yesterday you were asked to take a, I'm not sure if you had the oath or affirmation, but anyway, you promised to tell the truth.
It's true.
You recall that?
Yes.
You remain on that. Do you understand?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Mayne.
Good morning. I'm just going to ask a few, just a couple more questions about the sediment issues in the river. So if we could go to figure four in your evidence in chief. Up here of Google Earth images, the one in particular, the one on the left that shows the junction of the and the Waikato rivers, spectacular picture of the sediment discharge in the Waikato, entering the Waikato. Is that normal conditions in the Waikato, or have there been a recent rainfall event up the catchment?
I imagine that's shown that there's probably been a storm event in the Waipara catchment, and then that hasn't translated the same way. It would have been up to the greatest sort of catchment of the Waikato, and of course the Waikato River has a lot lower sediments anyway because of the impoundments. So there's about, I think, estimated 90% trapping of sediment through those, you know, dam impoundments. So I don't think that would represent a storm event in the Waipa catchment. Excepting that there is high sediment, but I don't know that would represent a base flow condition of the sediment load coming out of the Waipa. That's my concern.
Actually, I might just agree with you, because I took the liberty of going through the Google Earth imagery. It was about 25 or 30.
I know a lot about that. I haven't looked through 25 photos, and I'll just comment your words.
It's pretty dramatic.
Yep.
So you also say in your evidence that in terms of the sediment load that's being carried by the various rivers that come off the landscape, that bank erosion accounts for 60% of it?
From the work done by the technical leaders group, there was a paper done by Dr. Hughes at NIWA, and he made an estimate on the contribution of bank erosion, to the sediment load in streams, and so it's sort of a lot of guesswork, and he estimated that 60% was a fair estimate of the contribution.
That's not your work.
No, that's not my work.
Do you have any sense of what sort of processes were happening on the banks that were causing that? Was it because of cattle trampling on the bank, or was it eroding on the outside of the beam from the velocity of the flow?
There's certainly stock exclusion is important, but I think Dr. Lanier has sort of covered off on all those. When you have sort of some rather large land swale or mass wasting events, I think there's one that occurred, I can't remember the name of it, started with T, I think, but it's covered in Dr. Lemieux's evidence. But there was, when they talk about millions of cubic metres in one event that went into the river, and then as that works down the river, the problem is as well as that turbidity that created from an event, it's also now put so much feed load into the stream that the actual that the water levels come up, and so then that's now eroding from the bank material, like the volcanic less cohesive sort of sediment. So there's a lot of flow on effects from even those large events like that. So those are all confounding effects, but also in terms of in terms of what exact contribution that stock exclusion would be contributing to that event, and I'm assuming that's why the estimates of just stock exclusion, they tend to run with, and I think that the modelling that was done by originally in the process by, I think it was Graham Dool, Dr. Dool, they used about 40 or 50% of a reduction in the bankside erosion from stock exclusion. So I guess if you go, that's why my evidence is one of the corrections actually, is if you have 40 or 50% or 60%, that would mean a 24 to 30% make a reduction from the stock exclusion component. But yeah, there's certainly other sources of bank erosion that aren't just related to stock. Certainly the white part. And even in general, when you of course take all or push off land, get a higher runoff coefficients, yeah. and straighten the channels, and as you're saying, that movement of the river that's all part of the gain erosion component.
Are you aware that Mercury Energy, the resource consents that it has to operate the hydro dams down the Waikato River, one of the conditions of consent is to monitor bank erosion between Taupo and Narrawaia?
In the main stem?
Yeah.
Yeah, in that report by Dr. Hughes, it's referenced in my evidence, it's a 2015 report, 0% is contributed. There's 0% bank erosion that was assumed in the main stem, 60% was only in the tributaries. So they didn't think that bank erosion was a major issue. So that 60% doesn't apply to the main stem of the Waikato in the work that was done. So they assumed zero.
And that work shows that there's very little bank erosion occurring around the lakes or the mainstream stem. So it's all associated with the tributaries that are coming in.
And I think so that's relative to, if there will be some bank erosion, but I guess relative to the sediment load carried by the Waikato River, he's assumed that obviously insignificant.
Could I take a figure 3 in your rebuttal evidence, which shows an example of critical source areas and erosion sediment generation associated with critical source area.
Yes.
Are those images taken within the BC1 area?
I don't think so. I've just grabbed those from the Area Z website. An example of the critical source areas. I mean, and that's what I sort of consider to be ephemeral flow paths.
So, in terms of the requirements for PC1 to exclude stock and fencing and stuff, what do you think would be required under the requirements of PC1 to mitigate that sort of erosion?
And that's what, if you turn over to figure 4, just off the page, that kind of gives you some examples there, I guess, of activity-related critical source area management. So if you're using that for winter grazing, use what they call longitudinal grass buffers. So in figure 3 you're talking about, where you've got that water sitting with that erosive zone at that convergent contour, that's the type of thing that if you were doing, in my opinion, technical, if you were cultivating, that's that sort of thing, you should be leaving that as a longitudinal grass buffer, and that's how you'd be managing it. So if you had a lot of rainfall, you wouldn't get all that water coming down, a concentrated flow path then taking another slurry down there, which of course by the time that big slurry then hits it, longer that a perpendicular buffer, it's going to do nothing to sort of, so you want that grass buffer, that length to be intercepting that and sort of be not having that sediment sort of disturbed in that area that can be a critical source area. But if it was for normal stock grazing, then that may not be an issue. It might be okay to just stock grazing in there. So if you go to a higher risk activity, you might need to be, you know, and that's that whole critical source area assessment and management on farm, which may be, like I say, activity related as opposed to a permanent.
Does PC1 require or direct or result in things like what you showed up to before occurring? Is that PC1's going to achieve those sorts of mitigations in those critical source areas?
And I think that was the importance of why that certified farm planners or whatever that process is to have people that are able to identify those, because they are, from my understanding, critical source areas are an important part that is listed in PC1. And so, you know, if they're identified, then if you've got the right person doing those farm plans, then there should be appropriate mechanisms to be protecting those. So that's, I mean, there's a lot of, A, they have to be identified, and B, you have to have the right process. If you're cultivating, you shouldn't be running out. I guess, from a technical perspective, then it should be, that sort of maps identifying those critical source areas, and then ideally you wouldn't be cultivating or doing winter, intensive winter grazing within those sort of areas, because it's difficult to see how you can manage it as a critical source area if you're just doing high risk activities within those areas. Mm-hmm. And they have sort of reasonably high connectivity to the waterways, and they can convey, just from washing their large amounts of contaminants.
So turning the page again in your bubble, whether it's a figure 6 or figure 5, just some final questions around that. So the figure 6 shows an ephemeral flow path which is in pretty good condition. At least in that picture, it doesn't seem to need a lot of attention in terms of protecting that from sediment discharge. that's a critical flow path.
That's right.
Yeah. They could look like the ones that were in figure 3.
Yeah, I think that's what I was meaning by an activity related one. So if that was under normal grazing in that particular instance where it looks all right, and you had rainfall event and you had some concentrated flow moving across a grass area, then that might be low risk, whether or not we'll get into the E. coli issue, but the sediment. If that was freshly cultivated or it was an intensively winter grazed paddock where it was, bare soil and then you had rain, then probably where some of that blue arrow would be, that would be a critical source area because it would move a lot of sediment. So I don't know what's in the foreground of that. If that's the longitudinal graph buffer starting with, that's kind of an intermittent stream, and I guess that was that picture in there, which I think is from Southland. That's sort of trying to show that continuum of a terrestrial that would eventually, in that other figure 5, which sort of shows that blue arrow is kind of the terrestrial sort of part of the continuum of where water runs off the land, concentrates, and then ultimately moves into what are intermittent streams and into permanent ones. So that was the point there. So
we've been, other witnesses have stressed to us the need to perhaps to have stock exclusion and fencing in ephemeral streams. And I think your evidence suggests that make pretty clear that you don't think the effort to fence and stock exclusion in ephemeral streams is likely to be productive given the extra land that would
take. That's right. I consider ephemeral streams are actually terrestrial ephemeral flow paths, so actually flow paths. So you've got convergent contours, water concentrating on what are actually terrestrial paddocks.
So that's where I wanted to go. Was your understanding of ephemeral streams and whether your terminology, as far as you can tell, fits with what is perhaps generally considered to be an ephemeral stream or defined as a ephemeral stream. You quote some material there for Auckland Council. But we have heard that you know, 77% of erosion that results in sediment in the stream systems comes from the ephemeral stream part of the catchment.
It was quite a complicated paper, the McDowell paper, they were using the digital river network collage, you know, to sort of do that, and that doesn't really have a federal water path on it, so when they're talking about headwater streams, my understanding is that's more the intermittent and small perennial streams, not federal flow paths. And you get an indication of how much stream length is missing. I've read some of the it was some in the farmers' evidence and where they looked at overlay the river network that's used to sort of estimate stream length. And I think on one of those farms, the digital river network that we used only picked up 10% of the waterways on the stream. And so, and you get an indication of that because now there's, we were all talking about stream length, 18,000 kilometres of streams. That's using the, they call it the DN2, the digital river network, the second version, I guess. There's now a DN3 that's coming out. I'm assuming that's with LiDAR, but there is a DN3 for the whitewater. And that has not 18,000 streams, that has 28,000 streams. So it's found another 10,000 streams. And so of the first water strata water, there's another water, first and second. There's probably something like 7,000 to 8,000 extra kilometres, and probably that type of mapping of the DE3 would be probably then showing a lot more of those ephemerals. So I don't think the paper, McDowell is not referring to ephemeral flow paths. No. And that's the importance of there is still all ephemerals that are potential critical source areas, and that's because over the terrestrial environments they need to be managed as critical source areas, because that work of that I refer to, like Monaghan, was using some of those, you know, those photographs that show a well managed those sort of longitudinal grass buttons sitting at the base of those. They can be removed 70 to 90% of sort of sediment. So I think that's a management action that you're doing as part of the farm plan to mitigate the loss of contaminants from the terrestrial area before they enter into what we could deem for a filter stream.
Thank you.
You asked about 1863 yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did go back and read that, and it's on page 3 of that document. And that was about, in terms of the vision and strategy, to recognise that water quality and other natural resources have deteriorated since the onset of extensive settlement and agricultural development. So with respect to that period, relates to the New Zealand Settlements Act of 1863, which was when substantial tracts of land were confiscated from local use. So that was the reason.
Yeah,
that
was something that was put in the land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Bob, would you please?
Good morning.
Just a few questions, thank you. Could you turn to paragraph 1.8 of your evidence in chief? Is that the total sediment contributed by farming activities or something else?
That was, in my evidence, there's the pie charts that come in a bit later on in section 4. And so that's been estimated, what I call, but I was using the year 2012 long term soil erosion map, which I spoke to Manaki Fennell, and that was to give you the name for their version of the New Zealand, which is New Zealand empirical sort of erosion model. So that's dairy land, dry stock land, and then adding up all those the layers from that enzyme erosion model, basically. So that's what that those percentages look like. So it's the total loads using that enzyme or that long-term soil erosion map layer.
Okay, that doesn't mean a lot to me.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to understand is what is 100%? Is it other farming activities?
Oh, sorry. In terms of the other of everything else, so that's native. Like in the pie charts, I went a little bit of a pastoral focus, so I had, in terms of pastoral land uses, I separate that into dairy and dry stock, and then others, it's just every other land use, so that'll be scrub, naked land cover, urban, cropping. So is that what you're asking?
Well, that's what I'm asking, but I'm struggling a little bit with that, because where does forestry come in? Because presumably.
Oh, forestry.
So you're saying that 87% of all sediment comes from dairy and dry stock, is that right? Including from forestry and urban areas and everything else in the whole catchment. And you wouldn't know offhand what sort of equivalent figure forestry would have there?
No, but I could find it out. I just don't know if you guys know
it's fine.
And that was that comment I made yesterday about forestry has a 3 to 6 year disturbance, but over the long term, forestry actually, after that, once you've got canopy closure of the new forestry, it actually leaches very little. So over 30 year harvesting cycles, there's quite low erosion to that episodic ones, but I guess over the long terms, erosion from forestry is relatively low compared to pastoral.
I'm not totally convinced on that, because if you've got 5 years out of 30 years when it's discharging a lot of sediments, that could, and you have a next lot discharged over the next 5 years and so on. I thought you could get quite a lot of sediment from forestry. You know, think that one was.
I guess again you can. So even if you had, if it was really 2 or 3 times more than past year for 1/5 of its time, that's still, I guess over time that means it's going to be a lower. It's going to be you're going to have lower sediment yield per hectare under exotic forestry than you will have under pastoral.
Okay, that's fine.
In relation to that, that's perhaps an example of where steady cumulative effect on the dry stock and dairy, well, particularly the dry stock, can be much greater over the long haul than intense episodic events as they occur, depending on your time frame.
Yes, and I think we did mention the joint witness statement around sources of sediment. There was that statement that, or someone made a comment or acknowledging that forestry is also a source of sediment.
Sure.
But yeah, based on the layers that I used, that those pie charts reflected what the GIS analysis was using the national soil erosion layer from an Arctic water.
But isn't the point that while discharges from forestry land are certainly in the headlines and certainly represent a serious problem, it's not to take away from the scale of the issue coming from pastoral farming.
Correct.
That's very helpful, thank you. Could you please go to 1.13 of your evidence? Does not achieve a sufficiently large reduction in sediment losses, what's the next management option available to further reduce sediment from pastoral farming? Would that be more streams?
That comment was that we're focusing on sediment, but we sort of talk about critical resource areas, those are also important. But even I think it was maybe in account 65 or 6 of my evidence where I talk about really is it can be very large amounts of erosion coming from very small areas of the catchment, and I guess that's what has been the focus of Manawatū Whanganui, you know, region on the on requiring or space enhancing that sort of highly erodible land, and you know, the Ngāti Whenua's research there, I think, is you can have 70% reductions, or up to 90% if you have forests, those areas that are yield that are quite highly erodible. So that, again, using that same soil erosion layer, which I believe is, like I say, equivalent to being zinc, I think it was quite small. It was only 1.3% of the PC1, and that added up to 37% of the model erosion. So that would be an obvious that's obviously a big target. I mean, and affect those critical source areas, and I guess that's where the critical source areas will do, you know, how you then manage for that, it'd be big. Technically, the data shows there'll be sort of large winds available from concentrating on relatively small areas of currently parked land, is probably due to pastoral land.
Okay, so really what you're saying is that's an element that needs to be dealt with separately from plant environment in terms of the controls on farming activities, or are you saying that some of those highly erosive areas are within farm areas?
I'm pretty sure the analysis that I did was, I had my GIS person do, was still, you have farm boundaries, and within farm boundaries you can sometimes have bush cover, and so we focus on the land cover class or the high production grassland, and so I'm pretty sure that a lot of that work that I did was focusing on the pastoral land.
That's helpful to get it. Just in coming back to the issue of ecosystem health in the river, I still would like to try and understand that if a new attribute target is put for ecosystem health in terms of nitrogen, and we've heard various discussions on what that might mean, do you think if we're going from a toxicity target to a ecosystem health target, we're looking at maybe a 25% more stringent limit, or do you have any ability to comment on that, please?
So in the stock catchments, without looking too much at it, but even with nitrate toxicity, I'm assuming there'll be a lot of sites that have to maintain, and they are below the AB thing. So that's 1 meg per liter, or 1 milligram per liter of nitrate nitrogen. And there'll be a lot below that, and so they're actually quite low. So if you look at, and this is one of the challenges of how councils, you know, I guess, go about implementing 3.13, you know, which is the, and actually, when I was at NEWA, I actually wrote the document that became the three, co-wrote it with Matheson, Dr. Matheson, that I wrote a section on giving effect to downstream receiving environments, so lakes and mixing and estuaries and that type of thing. So I am quite familiar with that, and that was that purpose to start off as a note on the purifying table. And that's that point, is how many hard bottom streams are in the catchment, because that's where you apply the purifying.
A very simple answer.
Very simple
answer. Very difficult question.
Yeah.
If we're looking at the Waikato River, for example, and you have a situation now where you have to get down to, or you have to meet the toxicity targets, if you have to meet a ecosystem health target, would that be more stringent? Or at some stage that will be more stringent than more relaxed, wouldn't it, in terms of toxicity standards?
Yeah, I think for not certainly not all, but there will be some types of will be more stringent, yes.
And what I'm trying to get an understanding is how much more stringent would it be? 80% or 60% or 90%?
I don't know that it would be more stringent than what the current, because the current main stem Lake Trophic State ones are quite. So at the bottom of the river, we're looking at probably 20-25% reductions in nitrogen to meet the TDM trophic state ecosystem outside of the bottom. And then at the top, with the new site at Kapapiro, it's probably more like 30%. So I still think that maybe the reductions required at the subcatchments of those main seams may still be the main drivers for reduction, and more so than what than even without that uncertainty around how we apply those trophic state nitrogen targets in the subcatchments. I don't know that they'll be bigger than what the reductions would be at those points.
That's what I was trying to understand.
Sorry, I paid a lot of
attention. No, you obviously have a great love of your subject, isn't it? It's good to see. One last question, please. Could you turn to figure three? Thank you. This is your
evidence in chief here.
Page 9? Yes, page 9.
Yes.
Yeah. What I'm trying to understand is, what is a 200% change in clarity? What does that mean? Well, it's a reduction in clarity.
Yeah. Did you read footnote 7? That might, because it is a strange one, because of course
it was. I thought it did reduce the clarity and get worse. So,
so that tried to even give a slight worse example, because it's a bit different, because of course the scale goes the other way. You sort of and that's why it's not a reduction, it's an improved. I try and say it should say an improved.
I haven't read the footnote, I'm sorry. That does explain. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything arising out of the court's questions? Mr. Minhinnan.
Thank you. Just one point. There were some questions from Commissioner Hodges in relation to Overseer and the scorecard, and I was just wondering if I could take you to the Farm Systems Joint Witness Statement. And question 44. So this is page 401.0095. In the comments section, there's two graphs there, and was just wondering if you were able to look at that top graph, which I understand is comparing NRS score against measured nitrogen loss, and if you're able to comment on that, including in terms of the R squared number.
Yes, that graph was compiled by a farm systems expert at Dairy and Z, just based on all the, I think it came from past, some of the big MD work on the farm systems on Pastel 21, big program of work. And so that was just where you have these farm trials, so you're not actually that, the y-axis here isn't model overseer loss, that's measured loss, when you have all the little suction cups in the paddocks where you're collecting and measuring the actual sort of nitrate leaching. So that there was a limited data set, and admittedly there's some high numbers here that 400 is quite high for an NRS score, of course, but it was still just in the white knuckle, and so I imagine reasonably good regression, 69%, that I'm not sure is that may reflect similar climates and soils in that particular study area. So I don't know exactly where those farms were from the white report. That's useful or not, showing obviously a relationship between on average, the NRS score is increasing. It explains a fair bit of variance in the measured EBOS.
Thank you. No further questions.
Very helpful. Thank you.
And sorry, that bottom graph got chopped off. I think that's purchased in surplus on the x-axis of the chopped off graph. Or might have not chopped off in your version.
Well, it is chopped off.
Sir, in relation to that bottom graph, would it assist if a full version of that graph that isn't severed would it be helpful if that were provided?
Well, I think it would be. The comment above suggests that the first one is purchase nitrogen surplus versus loss, and the second one is purchase nitrogen surplus versus NRS, nitrogen reduction.
Yes, I understand that the top graph is, as Dr. Dupree has explained it, but perhaps if I can have, I think it was Mr. Wrightstow who added that to that JWS to just provide a...
It's always good to have the whole.
Indeed. Right. Thank you, Your Honour.
No, thank you very much.
Can I just clarify something with Dr. Dupree? Sorry, Dr. Dupree. Just a matter of clarification on the first graph. At the left-hand end of the curve, you've got your points on the graph are much closer together, much closer to the line than they are as you go further to the right. Does that mean that they would be a more accurate reflection of what's going on in those lower aggregate scores?
I'd like to be able to help you out on that, unfortunately. I don't know. Whether it be, we do have a document that looked like it was an 8-page that was written by the farm system to pull those graphs together, that was more useful than just the graphs.
But they're measured.
Yes.
So there's not a question of error there, it's just a question of what it means when you do your regression or try and otherwise fit your line.
I think when you do see suction cup type sort of things, there's quite big error bars that maybe will be on it. Yeah. So I'm sure there'd definitely be some. Within
within the measurement, that would be error.
So I might be able to.
Which error not demonstrated by the graph, it's just what you know from the way that the cups actually work.
Correct.
Yeah.
And as Dr. Dupree mentioned, if that those 8-page document would be useful as far as providing the context for it, have you ever made that available?
I suppose it helps clarify. I mean, this is one of the things, again, illusion of precision. And people say, well, I measured it. And you say, well, yeah, what sort of measurement tool did you use?
Certainly.
That's a matter. Maybe it's a meter.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dupree, for your evidence. You're excused.
So the final witness for Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand as far as the stage of the hearing is Mr. Willis.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Willis. Do you confirm your full name is Gerard Matthew Willis?
I do.
And you're a director at InFocus Limited. And you've prepared two statements of evidence, dated 28 July and 11 August 2023.
Yes,
and you were involved in the planning conferencing that resulted in joint witness statements in relation to these matters, and then a separate one in relation to point source discharges.
Correct.
And you have the qualifications and experience set out in your primary evidence.
I do.
Do you have any corrections to make to your evidence?
I do have two minor corrections, if that's okay. Some of my evidence in chief, late pages, from out of July. Paragraph 13.4, near the end of the first line, I said there is triaging, and of course I missed that. No out there, there is no triaging.
Which paragraph was that?
That was 13.4, starts in contrast to the management approach to pastoral farming.
Yes.
There is no tree.
Oh, sorry, I'm looking in the wrong place. Thank you. Thank you.
And then if we looked over a couple of pages to 13.21, a very minor one, I say, in my opinion, my capability proposal. So I like it, did not mind.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Now, there have been a number of changes to the provisions following your evidence in chief and then rebuttal. I wonder if it might assist the court if you were to briefly just take the court through those changes that have subsequently been made.
Yes, certainly. Happy to do that. I'll try and keep it reasonably brief. Perhaps just an introductory comment that, of course, I think Mr. Manning said this in submissions. Many of the changes I proposed in my version attached to my evidence in chief were kind of structural changes designed to try and create a very consistent approach across all land uses. The great bulk of those were not substantive. In the sense of making a material difference, and in order to assist the court outside of it, given that it's extended, that many of those could be left to fall away. So there is a significant difference, obviously, in the version that the statute needs to be achieved in the version now, opposed to the statute of the means. So I made there is a convergence, I guess you'd say, between where I announced it, and some of those were non standard. There is one substantive point, and again, it was not mentioned, but it's to do with the threshold between low and moderate risk dairy farming, which I've now agreed with Mr. Cavillo, which would be at the 20th or 30th percentile or 50th percentile. That's a substantive movement. And then there are a handful, but really only a handful of outstanding issues and differences between Mr. Cavillo's version and my own. And they relate to clarification and the requirements of certification, the requirements around regular reporting, the court of information and reporting officers. And that relates to stock exclusion, which I'll come to in a little more detail in a moment, and the requirements around recertification and the timing of that recertification, before the time of recertification. And then one or two matters related to these CVP provisions. So I might just take the court briefly to those in the latest version that's attached to the submission.
And so these are the attached to the legal submissions performed here and there in New Zealand.
Yes. So the version, which I know there's many, many versions of this. The one looks like a grey wash.
So, could I just clarify if any of these have been changed by what was handed out yesterday?
Yes, I'll come to that in a moment. So, the stock exclusion, so the part of Schedule C which relates to stock exclusion has now been replaced as a little more defensive evidence. So on policy one, I think how we track and deal with the intensification risk is currently kind of a missing piece of the policy framework. I think my view is that it would be useful to be a clear about what we are proposing in that regard. So that's condition DA in policy one. So that's what's kind of that. The way we do that is actually already kind of in the provisions and the rules. But it's not reflected in the policy, in my opinion, so I was trying to bring that through with the policy. If we just look over the page to policy 2G, sorry, 2B G, and I'll just make a correction there as well, if I may, there's a reference there to standards 1, 3, and 5, as you can see, and I should use standards 1. The rest of it's not especially material, but I'm sure it's there at some point. Then on the policy 3, as a result of Jacob's got a proper president in the JWS, I should raise about the drinking water, I've put this up already, but I propose that we add to the policy requirement to consider the exceedance of drinking water standards for new CDP, and that just so it's considered in the context of a discretionary consent application. Across the page in 4, policy 4.
Sorry, Mr. Willis, could I just come back to that issue of drinking water standards? The way to where this does concern me a little bit. If all we wanted to do is make sure they consider them, why not just say that?
Yes, it's a good point, Commissioner. I have reflected on that. This is expressed as a sort of prohibition.
Yes.
And it may be more appropriate to express it as consideration. And I think you talk about that. It's something I'm certainly open to do a bit more.
Thank you.
Across the page on 4, I was trying to make clear again that the fresh water plan is fairly obvious and it's a matter, I guess, but the fresh water farm plan or farm environment plan also reports to us by the stocking rate and the nitrogen risk. It didn't state that clearly, so I thought that was worth adding. I think that's just about it on the policy. There's a few things in the rules that might be useful to talk about briefly. If we go to the rule 3 on page 27, or rule 3, 11, 4, 3, 4. I propose that another matter, or another condition be added, that records be kept and reported annually is what we can't, what I can't say. Whether this annual reporting is necessary and appropriate possibly depends on the cost of that, but it doesn't seem to me that if I put this together, it would seem to me that would be a significant obligation, but there may be enough to suggest that it's more than that. But some of the point is that the record needs to be kept and available for the council to address.
Well, all it would be keeping a record of either stock numbers or nitrogen scores.
Correct, yes. And I've said reported annually, but we'll be talking about what reporting is. I'm going to come on to reporting and talk about that. I may as well mention this issue now, and in the same rule, when we get down to 6D, there's the issue about the data's reference to the regulation. And I would agree with Mr. McMahon when he mentioned the other data today, Mr. McMahon. That maybe the way that we do this, but the point is that, in my view, that the plan needs to stand alone, and certification is such an important, high quality EDP. I guess the success or failure of this plan will depend on quality EDPs, and so certification of EDPs is important, and I think the requirements of certification will be part of the plan and may be satisfied by meeting the requirements of the regulations. But it should stand as an independent requirement for the plan. So that is what those references aim to. Now, I went a little bit mad with the way I referenced it. His reference in a few places isn't needed, but I'll come on to that.
The risk is that we're in a time of transition for the governing statute, and whether or not, in wording it that way, how is it to be interpreted if the minister or parliament should make some wholesale change to the regime during the life, the anticipated life of the pension?
I think the issue here, though, is that I have a free hand and I'll start again. I might draft this so as the requirements of EDPs remain a requirement of the plan, but could be satisfied by the required by the chief of the regulations. And therefore, if the regulations change, will move the way the requirement remains.
Indeed. Yeah. Okay.
I won't take you through some of those minor changes to the rules of the material for current purposes. I might jump actually right now to the schedule C. Actually, no, I won't. Go to D, sorry, to tie up those issues. We talked about the form issues, and I would like to make a change to here. I think I've reflected on the schedule D1 reporting requirements, which are set out in part D number 2. Cost out text, of course, is what the hearings panel is meaning. They were also seeking annual reporting of a potential structure done for loss and not increase or decrease according to the tools to be approved. I'm going to move on a little bit. I think the point here, I think what I think is important is that there is regular reporting. I'm suggesting 3-year reporting. I don't think it should be decoupled from the reference to certification, so I would strike out actually on fashion the words after the demonstrator say at each 3-yearly certification on the EDP. I'd strike those out and simply replace it with every 3 years. And so we have a 3-year requirement to report a rolling 3-year average of, and I think this is the important part, key metrics. So the stopping rates, the LBS, it's an imperfect measure, but what we've got, and in the NRS 4, since indeed there are other units that come along, like the NUV index, risk index, TTIO is there, price up scorecard, or whatever else, that can be used as substitute for the stopping rate. So that is a 3-year reporting, and then if we flip to across a couple of pages to Part E, number 2, there is a separate requirement here, which is somewhat conflated, but I've tried to use in part, a farmer grant should be recertified. And I think because I've now covered it from the reporting side, I think it can remain at 5 years. I see no reason for 3 years, but I don't have a problem with what separate forms of certification to be 5 years according to the regulations. But by that, we also have recertification in order to review and a recertification effectively when there is a material change in what's happening on the property. Now, someone asked, where the 5% came from. Just to be clear, that was the proposal in Mr. Trevilko's evidence, first version of the evidence in chief. So that was the genesis of that. I'll just continue through. I think there are some changes required to it on reflection. I think for a start, it should be a 3-year rolling average to allow for some inter-annual variability, which you all know, we're not making widgets and farming that. Systems which go up and down in response to climate conditions in other places. So I would refer that to a 3-year rolling average, and I've certainly got a very large bold square bracket around a 5%. That may not necessarily be appropriate number, and that may be something that's more appropriately clarified by the farmer, but I don't know what that would be. I've simply taken that percentage.
good. Can I please just clarify how firm you feel about 3 years as a 5 year rolling average return?
I don't have a problem with a 5 year rolling average as long as the reporting is on a 3 year basis. I think a 5 year review would only teach you to get 1 review in life at hand, which isn't very much when you're dealing with a risk of this nature, but it's a potential scale. So I think that the good of a scale of 5 year rolling would be not so important as if it was a 3 year for 45.
Thank you.
And just while we're on that page, I think there were two or three examples that obviously picked them up now that we can wind up, but I'm sure that there was a reference there to as the regulations, again, how the regulations existed in the system, German, that was not intended to be there. That reference was only intended to apply in relation to the certification, but I think that's a little bit carried away.
So to clarify that, that's in part G, are you referring to?
In part G, we're refused to board, that's good. Sorry, this is taking a bit longer than I thought, I apologise. The only other thing that I was going to introduce with you was the stock exclusion changes that were speculated yesterday. And perhaps just to wipe away this, to me, one of the differences between Mr. Chivilko's version and where I said my stock exclusion was the possibility, I feel, that we could get no fencing about 10 degrees. Because the test, there was really not a lot of tests as to when it might be attractive, or what may be necessary to use alternative, what that alternative might be, or how effective it would be for needed to be. It did seem to me quite possible that you might end up with no heat in about 10 degrees, which I thought was probably not as ambitious as we probably need to be. And so the version we've got here in front of us now, although now talks about a 10 degree threshold, it also requires heat and stock exclusion of permanent or temporary flowing streams that are 1 meter wide, above 10 degrees. Except that, acknowledging the issues that have been raised by a number of farming witnesses about the practicality of that potentially, is that the ability to, for a certifier or certified farm planner to certify that it's impractical to exclude stock from those in business streams, and that there are alternatives which will take us towards or at least mitigate the impact. So it's a little bit of a halfway house in that regard, picking up what I thought the best elements of the various proposals on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. And do you confirm that the contents of your evidence are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do, yes.
Thank you. Please answer any questions from my friends in court.
Thank you, Your Honour. And good morning, Mr. Willis. Now, somewhat unusually, I'm largely going to focus you on the legal submissions for my questions today. But that's because that's where most of the recent changes to provisions are. So the main document, two documents you'll need to have in front of you, are the legal submission version from Fonterra and Dairy NZ, and also the document that was handed up yesterday. So you've already got those there, and I think the court does as well. I'm going to step you through. We'll step through some of the key changes, not all of them, because I appreciate there's matters of detail in some. But if I can start with policy 2, and take you to that page 16 of the Fonterra and Dairy NZ version. And we've got there policy 2. the changes you've made are in F and G. I'm not going to worry about F at this point, but in terms of G, this provision relates to the scenario where stock are not excluded from waterways. That's right, isn't it? And so in terms of the impact of the change that you've made here, as I read it, under F is the general exclusion, and under G you're saying there should be a 5-year period where farmers should not have to ensure adverse effects on stock on wood bodies and minimise if they're not fencing, is that right? Is that your intention?
That's not my intention. The point here is to say, once you're not committed to activity and you're in a longer period of time, then that's, I understand that you might need a lot of time, but there's other measures that can, that should perhaps be taken to look at the effects in the following direction.
Yes, and so the question of how we deal with that, we'll come back to the time frame. In terms of how it's dealt with, you're not intending to say that that there's a 5-year period where points 1 and 2 under paragraph G don't apply, isn't it? So that perhaps that's a matter of how it's expressed in the drafting, as it might be a bit of an issue.
There may be an issue. I mean, I think there is my way of thinking, there is a requirement to achieve the 5 years in a reasonably steady state. So there's a period of 5 years.
The time frame expressed somewhere else, perhaps, rather than in the policy, if that's the case.
I'm open to that suggestion, yes.
Turning now to Rule 311.4.3. And the addition of new condition 4 in the Quantier version. So this is a permitted activity rule for low intensity farming, and the effect of your proposed condition 4, as I read it, is to require that every farmer operating under this rule essentially has to prove their permitted activity status to the council every year. Is that your intention?
It's the intention that there is an ability for that to be proven every year. As I say, less focused on the reporting aspect than I am on the reporting aspect. When I put this together, it seemed to me that entering a stocking rate or NRR score in a council portal once a year would not be particularly onerous, and probably less onerous than doing the GSP or annual company return or something. But if I'm wrong on that, and it is much more onerous, then I'm quite open to the prospect that it could be on a less frequent basis or on a on-demand basis.
Yes, and there's a question about keeping good records to ensure that risk can be assessed over time and intensity can be assessed over time, isn't it? That seems like quite a beneficial thing to ensure.
Sorry, that's just the beginning of that question.
Yes, keeping track of intensity of land use over time is valuable so that you can track whether it's increasing or decreasing, isn't it?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? That's part of the intensification management.
So then it's a workability question as to how that's implemented in practice.
That's correct.
And under the council's approach, and it's in D1, but the council's approach would require demonstration every 5 years that the risk of discharges is not increasing, so that's another way of achieving that, isn't it?
Yeah, so I see that there are slightly different things. I say one is a condition of the rule, so you need to record in order to make the gateway test of the rule effectively, or at least the condition of the rule, perhaps as well. The other one is the report.
5-year reporting, given that we've gone from the panel recommendation to an annual report, just so that we left to a 5-year reporting, and you don't even pitch it one set of data over a 10-year period, which is the way it was planned. Seems a fairly light oversight.
If you had a chance to have a look at the federated farmers and deer and beef and lamb version of that same rule?
Yes, I have got it in front of me.
Yes, it might be worth pulling it out. We might come back to it later too, but if you pull that. Yes, I think there's a requirement there that farmers keep a record of the nitrogen risk score and stocking rates, which could then be used in that 5-yearly period to report to the council.
That's right. I mean, it's drafted slightly differently, but it's essentially the same. If you strike out the annual report of the nitrogen, it'll be assessed.
And so, in case it's the council's comfortable with that suggestion that farmers keep a record of some of those things each year, but then don't provide them to the council every year, there's a bit of a difference there in terms of the way that's provided. So that would be a way to keep track of the records, wouldn't it? Without necessarily having the burden of providing it every year.
That's correct. The question is, what is the marginal benefit of providing to the council? And what is the cost of providing to the council? And that's the question, I suppose. I think most of the effort comes in some angle to a corner, but we don't know whether they're recording it, they're being quite crude. That's my problem.
Thank you. Turning now to Rule 311.4.4. And in particular the conditions of this. This rule relates to moderate intensity farming, which requires a controlled activity consent. And you've sort of changed there to condition 2, to provide that the rule only applies if the farmer can exclude stock within 10 years. Is that that's the effect of that condition? Now, the difference between that and the council's version is, in the council's version, Schedule 2 says you've got a fence within 2 years, but of course if you're in a resource consent scenario, the applicant could explain why 2 years in terms of the minimum farming standards in Schedule C was not practicable, and the council could then fix a tailored time frame through a consent condition, couldn't it?
That's one interpretation. I think the problem I had with this rule is it wasn't entirely clear what a tailored solution was and whether that included a fixed time frame or a longer time frame, or whether it was an alternative, several alternative measures like or some other method of trying to control the impact of stock loss in a output strain. And the issue that I had with this rule was just having been certain that it wasn't possible for a farmer to apply essentially to farm without stock exclusion and can only take non fencing methods away. So my solution was, I think the control of the utility rule needs to be founded in a firm and clear way. And the way that I thought was important was to do that was to set a time frame. Because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is, if it's practicable for a stock solution to be put in place through fencing, but it's just a matter of time and cost, then that is where the control utility ought to focus.
can if you want to take longer than 10 years, it will take a long-term permanent alternative measures. It doesn't involve instant tax, something with the greatest scrutiny and potentially the ability to turn down through the FDA or RDA potential.
Is your concern there that there's a controlled activity rule, someone might apply for the activity of not stock excluding and therefore the council can't decline that?
That is always a grey area with these controlled activities. It's what is the activity you're applying for and therefore what conditions can be, or how strong the conditions can be proposed before you agree with the activity you apply for. I think there is a possibility that you could apply for the activity of farming without stock exclusion under this rule, which couldn't then be turned down. And that was what I was trying to, that's one of the things I was trying to guard against.
Well, it might be a point we differ on, because my interpretation of this rule is that it applies to the activity of farming. But an activity for which a controlled activity consent is required can always be subject to conditions, can't it?
Of course, yes.
And so the question is, what are the parameters within which that farming should occur? And my interpretation of this rule is that it would allow the council to set a condition relating to stock exclusion, and that wouldn't be a declining of the consent. But is that something you differ with, or is it something that you think, in terms of the way this is expressed, it could be clearer? Because I think those are two different things.
Yes, no, I accept that. I think it's grey, the grey area that could lead to debates, that as to whether I can apply for the activity of farming without stock exclusion. The 4B says you're farming to which cannot meet the stock exclusion standards. And the question is, who determines whether they cannot meet them? Which ones are we talking about? And I'm assuming it must be the applicant who determines, and then the applicant applies saying, I cannot achieve them because they're too expensive, and I can't do it. Therefore, applying to farm or the upside solution. And where that leads to council authority. Particularly in the instances we're not particularly clear conditions about around those, or matters of control around those, being able to address that situation. I think it would need to, if you're going to persist with that sort of a control to the rule, you would need to have, it would be preferable to have much clearer matters of control that says the council could control the extent of fencing that was required and the time frames around which that could be done. That's the way I would look at it.
Yes, so that would be one way of avoiding the risk of the scenario you've described as being your core concern, wouldn't it?
That would be one way to do it.
And if there's a scenario where that's the way it's applied, whether because there's a particular matter of control relating to stock exclusion requirements, or simply because that's the way the rule was being read, would you accept that there is already flexibility in this rule for a farmer to say to the council, we can't do it within 2 years, appreciate it's important, can we give a staged approach to over 5 years, or 10 years if that was necessary? And that's able to be implemented through the council's version of this rule.
I may have lost the thread of that question, but I think if I understood you to say that there may be, if the intent was to allow someone to fence or partially fence over a stage over a particular time frame, could that be achieved through a controlled activity rule? Or possibly, I don't think it's clearly achievable under the council's version of the rule.
Okay. In terms of what the rule signals, the addition of a reference to 10 years in there could be read by some as an indication. interpretation that up to 10 years is acceptable. Would you accept that?
Well, it might be, but that's why I did include the additional additional measures of control through Romans 3 and 3a, which say the time frame on the software for the which I suppose it is and the ability to impose some sort of schedule of time frames and staging, so if we didn't, we're clearly going to be able to impose conditions which allow the council to require progressive or progress towards that rather than all the year 10.
Yes, and so the scenarios we've got on the council's approach, the expectation of 2 years, but could apply for a consent that involved a stage program for longer, or the version you've got here, which would say you've got 5 years under a consented scenario, but you could apply for it to be up to 10. So that's the, broadly speaking, the two options we've got here, isn't it? The council's version, because of the 2 year minimum standards in Schedule C, would say, well, you've got 2 years, but if you're applying for a consent, you could ask for longer if that was necessary and justified. Or the version you've got here, where because of the matter of control and the matter of the condition you've got here, you've been given up to 5 years, or you could apply for up to 10. That's probably it, isn't it?
That's correct, and I think that's consistent with the version
in some cases 2 years might be enough, like in Darwin. And I think we heard from Ms. Slattery yesterday there's no more fencing to do because it's all done. So there's likely to be a range here.
Of course.
Yeah. And so if there was a signalling, perhaps thinking about, not quite from a positional bargaining perspective, but if there was a signal that 5 or 10 years might be alright in the plan rather than an expectation of 2, unless it's impracticable, that would be a step backwards in terms of what the plan's achieving, wouldn't it?
I don't know that I'd look at it that way. I think you've also got to consider the stock exclusion regulations which would kick in, which certainly would get people working earlier than 5 years, as I recall. So I'm sure they will start with the national stock exclusion obligations. We'll maybe have to take a period of time and then move on to meeting these obligations within 5 years if they can to avoid a consent. So, yes, quite a long period in two, but I'm not sure what we mean is a great delay and people don't actually have something.
When I read your evidence and I notice that right at the outset, I guess there's one of your general principles that you've supported were applied throughout. In paragraph 1.2, you've noted you've supported changes that would generally increase the stringency of key parts of the policy and rule framework to enhance the likelihood of target attribute states being met. Do you accept that's still an important principle when the court's considering these provisions? Turning now to rule 311.4.7. Now, this is the default rule, and one of the things that you've suggested here is to delete the conditions in that rule to ensure it's clear that it is a default rule. And I can advise that the Regional Council is content to do that in order to resolve that point of concern that you have raised and others have raised. Would you agree that with that deletion made, if that deletion is made, that when it comes to assessing a consent application under this rule, the sort of guidance that the conditions would have provided is already inherent in the policy framework and in things like the matters of control and discretion that existed in the rules that you might default to this one from.
Yes, that was part of the assessment I did to determine whether it was whether there'd be any loss by subscribing to those conditions.
Yes, and so in summary, your view is remains that there wouldn't be anything lost because of those factors.
That's correct, yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Conway, I appreciate you put this as part of a question to a witness, but may we and other parties proceed now on the basis that the rule 3.11.4.7 might be read as finishing at the end of the first paragraph and without the word subject to following conditions?
Yes, Your Honour, the specific drafting we have not done yet to confirm, but essentially, yes, that is,
yeah,
that is an update to
the and the reason that you put to the witness and that he's agreed with, it will just be a straight, everything else, discretionary activity, will assess it on the basis of an application.
Yes, that's right, sir.
All right, thank you.
So it's turning now to Schedule C, and I'm conscious that this is the component that has been an update to. But I do just want to check in terms of the way that this was framed up until yesterday afternoon. I just want to test some of the reasoning for that because it helps to provide context for the changes that have now been put forward. So it may be useful to have both of those versions in front of you. But looking first at the legal submissions version for Fonterra and DRNZ, in terms of stock exclusion, one of the key changes that you were seeking here up until yesterday from the council version was to change it back to a 15-degree slope, wasn't it? And doing that would be easier if we had good quality 15-degree maps, and also it would be helpful without a ground truth in any event, whatever the slope is. So, in terms of those maps, you've heard some of the discussion about the possibility of updated LiDAR maps, and of course, Dr. Dupree rightly recognised sometimes the smoothing inherent in the MFE maps might actually be useful, but provided that these provisions could rely on the most up-to-date MFE or a ground truth assessment, you'd support that.
Yes, in fact, the version that was tested yesterday does provide for that, but I could have pointed out. I've tried to indicate that it's the MFE 10-degree site map or shown by a replacement stock, a stock exclusion 10-degree site map published on the Regional Council website as the alternative. So.
Yes. And if the court were to opt for 15 degrees, then that would be updated simply by referring to, for example, Dr. Dupree's maps, or alternatively an updated map provided by the Regional Council.
It could do, yes.
Now, turning to the stock exclusion requirements themselves, you're aware that part of the purpose of having farm environment plan is to allow an on-site assessment of the particular circumstances a farm is operating under to ensure the measures implemented on-site are fit for local purpose?
Yes.
And does the degree of trust being placed in FEP certified us to exercise good judgment on-site?
Considerable trust, I say, yes.
And the certifiers are making that judgment in the context of some quite specific guidance in the plan about intended outcomes?
Sorry,
sir? Yes.
I wouldn't say quite specific, but they are general indications of the effects that need to be addressed.
Yeah. Yes, and in particular, reducing the four contaminants entry into waterways.
Yes.
Now, in that context, and I'm conscious of the version you've circulated yesterday, but the council's version included an ability for the FFP to involve a tailored solution on steeper land, provided the certifier certifies that the tailored solution will variously prevent, minimise, or reduce the discharge of the full contaminants. And that kind of approach has some value in trying to strike a balance between setting clear requirements and also allowing farmers some flexibility to tailor those requirements on steeper land so that the plan changes practically to implement. You'd agree with that?
Yes, depending on what a tailored solution actually means, it wasn't ever really defined as what that expression means, but clearly allowing discretion to be exercised by a farmer planner, such as a is an important aspect of the plan generally and could be used in some special contexts, yes.
Yes, and so in principle, subject to how it's implemented, you support the council's desire to strike that balance?
I support the principle that where it becomes impractical to stop exclude, then there is some discretion about who makes that judgment and about what you do where it does prove to be or can demonstrate to be impractical to stop exclude.
Yes, and I presume that's why you're now comfortable that Fonterra and other farming parties' version includes a similar pathway.
It's similar but slightly narrower because I guess the version makes the determination that at least for permanent, 1 meter permanent streams, it's regarded as something that should be done. So it's limited the discretion somewhat further than the council's version does.
Yeah. Looking at the slope at this point, if the slope was to be set at 10 degrees, there would be a larger proportion of farms that would be able to make use of the tailored solution under the council version.
10 degrees is 15 years to be about, I think it's about 50,000 hectares.
Now, turning over the page in the Legal Submissions version to Clause 5 of Schedule C, there are two parts to that, or two parts where there are changes. And in the second part, so the first part I understand relates to land under 10 degrees or 15 degrees as it was before yesterday. And the second part is land above 15 degrees. Is that how that works? A is below 15 and B was above?
That's correct, yes.
And so the effect of the change in B is to exempt streams that are narrower than 1 metre from the stock exclusion requirement on steeper land. Is that that's the net effect of it?
Yes, or conversely to require stock exclusion from 1 metre on 4 to 3.
But in relation to streams narrower than 1 metre, am I reading it right?
Yes,
so right. This doesn't apply to that, so they don't need to be fenced in any circumstances.
No, they don't need to be fenced. However, the general versions of the Tata Bar Plan and the requirements to deal with the serious lessons that we continue to apply.
Yes. And so the evidence, as I understand it, certainly from Dr. Dupree's, where he said he believes PC1 needs to maximise the number of streams that are stock excluded by fencing. This would be a departure from that approach, really, wouldn't it? Because you're really going to set an exception for narrower streams.
I
three and other witnesses and myself will all agree that the more stock exclusion, the better, the more chance we're going to reach the outcomes of objectives of code attributes states that PC1. But that needs to be balanced with all the other considerations. So it's always a question of balance and where to strike a reasonable level, at least for a particular plan time frame, what happens in the remaining 60 years or whatever it might be of reaching the target is another matter. This is, I guess, a first step, and quite a material first step. Okay. So I accept it's a doctrine of pre-evidence, but you know, it's not the only piece of evidence that's relevant to the determination.
Now, looking at the version he ended up yesterday, I think we have already stepped through the key differences that are substantive from the previous Fonterra and Gear NZ version. And you acknowledged earlier today that some of the changes you've previously recommended were in terms of drafting and structure rather than necessarily substantive. And I think my reading of the changes to Schedule C is that there are some changes here that are substantive that we've talked about, and a lot of the other ones are structural. Would you accept that?
I think if there were some changes made in putting this together, which are structural, but they are structural to try and make it a little bit simpler to follow, I've certainly found that Schedule C quite complex, there's a lot of things going on, and so we just took the opportunity to try and make it a bit simpler. So, yes, the answer to your last question is yes, there's some structural issues, but I think they are different for clarity.
Yes, and so in terms of the key differences that are not structural, it seems, and I may not capture them all, but one is the change in slope from 15 to 10. Another is the change to exclude narrower streams on steeper land. Another is to introduce this concept of certified tailored solutions that was previously only in the council's version, and I think Federated Farmers and Beacon Land. Those are, you know, plus the longer time frame for actually carrying out stock exclusion. Are they the key differences in substance?
Yeah, for the longer time frame being the 5 years as a permitted activity.
Yes, so it'll be 5 years as a permitted activity to carry out the stock exclusion under this approach.
Excellent. And the other one is possibly the version that you talked about before, the version for the alternative map to use.
Yes. And perhaps one more as I look at it. 5E is a change there, so that it's only wetlands greater than 500 square metres as opposed to 50 square metres that have achieved stock exclusion. Thank you. Turning to Schedule D1. There are a few changes here. I don't want to take you through all of them, but the first of them is this italicised paragraph that says essentially all permitted activity, farm environment plans need to be certified, whether or not that's required by the regulations. And you'll recall that the decisions version of Plan Change 1 expressly provided that Schedule D1 farm environment plans did not have to be certified. And that was the systems and deleted process above that records that. And so obviously the regulations took that out of the council's hand, at least to some extent, and required that farm environment plans on certain land size parcels just had to be certified regardless. Do you know how many additional farm environment plans would need to be certified under your proposed amendment?
Additional to what's required under the regulations or under?
Yes.
No, there will be some.
So explore the extent of the impact that might have on the industry's ability to service that requirement.
No, I don't know the impact of that. I mean, we're talking about
now, stepping down to the next paragraph from here, and this is the question of locking in the regulations as at the 6th of June. Under that approach, if there is an amendment to the regulations in the future, you'd agree that the council and people in the region would need to comply with both the plan change and with the modified regulations. They both apply, wouldn't they?
Well, yes, but I think what I tried to say earlier is the intent was this was just providing the certification aspects of the regulations. So if the regulations change to not require certification, for example, then the other thing is the way that this was designed would be that the certification, notwithstanding that the change to regulations would continue to apply. So it's the most stringent of the two things would apply in respect only of certification. Otherwise,
that's helpful to make sure we're clear on that, because you can appreciate there would be challenges if there's essentially a locked-in version of the full set of regulations and then that's somehow being preserved.
Oh, look, I agree. You don't want two sets of regulations and the schedule of the plan and all sorts of other contracts. It would be a very difficult situation. That's not what I'm aiming to achieve. It will quite appreciate.
And it would be likely, wouldn't it, that if there was a change to the regulations in a way that modified the way they applied through this plan change or related to this plan change, the council is likely going to need to have a plan change process to update its plan. Is that wrong?
Well, it might, and I guess that's the problem. What we don't want to have, I guess, is a hole in PC1.
Okay. Well, it sounds to me like it's a matter of drafting that might need to be some more work done on if that needs to be achieved.
Yes.
Turning to the submission of a certified plan, there's this paragraph here where that's framed as the one stating if necessary the farm environment plan may be submitted. Your key point here is, isn't it, that you want to ensure the farm environment plan is submitted to the council once it's been certified, is that?
That is correct. It just struck me that I didn't know how the council would be aware that there was a certified farm plan and is that
secret. Yes, and so would a way to express that here be to say the farm environment plan must be certified, must be submitted to the council once it's been certified? And then obviously there's the provision here which would presumably remain saying you can submit it before certification if you need to meet the time frame, but resubmit after it's been recertified or after it's been certified this change. Now finally, in relation to rule gateways, in the event the court was to decide to include dual gateways using overseer and the nitrogen risk scorecard, there would need to be some drafting to implement that.
Some drafting
done in the plan to implement that.
Absolutely.
And I just wanted to take the chance to get your views on the drafting that Federated Farmers and Beef and Lamb have done in the version attached to their legal submissions. Have you got that there? I think there was a bound volume somewhere that you witnessed.
Okay, sorry, right.
in Schedule B of that version on page 37. And that you'll see there, there's a new paragraph AA in brown text, and over the page there is a new table 1, which is a reinsertion of the old table 1. And a general and open question, have you had a chance to consider that, and do you have any comments on that, that wording, if that was the direction of travel that the court was to go down?
So which particular wording are you talking about?
The two parts that I've referred to, Commissioner AA.
Yeah, that's fine, thanks.
And then the table over the page.
Short answer, I haven't It does sound, it does, just from my quick look, it seems fairly similar to the text that still exists at one point. But I haven't done the answers of the differences, so I'm not sure I'm happy.
That's fine. And in terms of the principle here, you'd agree with Mr. Tribilco that in an ideal world we would have only one gateway to avoid uncertainty or confusion as to which activity class an activity falls within?
Yes, I do agree with
that. Yes. But we may not be living in an ideal world, at least momentarily.
We don't, sadly.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Ms. Willis. So my questions are going to focus entirely on the stock exclusion Schedule C that was filed yesterday by your council. So just before we get into those, just in terms of those changes that were filed, did that involve experts for the Director General in drafting of those of that version?
No.
So you only involved the select group of parties in the drafting of that version?
Well, the parties' names, yes. Do
you think it might be helpful to involve the experts like Dr. Robinson and Ms. MacArthur and Ms. Kessick in development of that version?
I guess everyone's been involved in talking about this over the period of the quite a lot of time, including this conference. So, I mean, I'm certainly aware of other speakers at this point.
Wouldn't it have been useful and helpful for the court to take account of those other perspectives?
I think I certainly have taken account of other perspectives. I've certainly heard all the evidence, I've listened to the witnesses, and of course the evidence on all sides, and a balance has been struck. And I've supported the version that I have because I think it's a reasonable balance for all the evidence that I've heard, including the evidence from the witnesses.
Would you agree that in terms of resolving the live issues, because clearly the Director General has put forward a different version based on the expertise of the witnesses put forward. And so, given those live issues in this hearing regarding setbacks, would it be helpful to the court if it had views of other witnesses other than farming interests sort of factored into that version?
Perhaps if I just explain a little bit about the setbacks issue, you will have noticed that I have not addressed the question of setbacks in either of my statements or evidence, and I did not engage in a discussion about setbacks in the system of the city either. I think this in a minute, I did point it out during the presentation of these yesterday that some aspects of the proposals come in a table reflection of the views of federal farmers and these are names that not necessarily been part of the discussion, court discussion about the other aspects.
view as an expert planner, do you have a view?
On setbacks?
Yes, in particular, we'll get into the detail, but just these initial questions, given your response to me just there, indicating that whilst I understand Ontario doesn't have a view, particularly on Clause 2 of Schedule C as proposed yesterday, what is your view?
My view is, for a start, I have well dealt with this issue around the country and other places quite extensively. I haven't applied my mind deep into this issue because it wasn't part of my brief, so I just haven't got on there, I guess you'd say. But I mean, it's very much a harassment solution. There is an ultimate outcome from a technical point of view, and there is a practicality lens to use to put over that. So, slope curves. We've seen in the units and the KWS, we've seen many times before, are always a form of debate. It's a question of where on that curve we draw a line. And that is going to be determined in part by the technical benefits, it's probably up to the technical witnesses, but also by the question of cost and practicality of the current space. So, my view is that the numbers that are put in there, that are in there now, and which reflection was in Mr. Kaluko's version, are a reasonable point to fill in the challenges that the farmers face in the US come across.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. So, if we can now just turn to that version so that you have a copy, of course, in front of you.
Yes.
So, I just want to step through just to ensure I understand. It's supposed to work, but also to get an understanding of your interpretation. So, I'm focusing obviously on Clause 2, where the stop exclusion provisions are. And so, if I'm reading Clause 2C correctly, 3 metres from the outer edge of the bed for other water bodies, unless a farm environment plan for the property has been prepared in accordance with 1, Part 9A of the RMA, and the RM Freshwater Farm Plan, REGS, and a certifier appointed by the Regional Council in accordance with those regulations has certified in writing that those minimum 3 metre setbacks is not practicable, then in which case setbacks shall be a minimum of 1 metre or average of 3 metres as certified by the certifier. Yep, so you've got 3 metres, unless these exceptions apply, and it's shown to be impracticable, then it's less than 3 metres, it's an average of, 1 metre or an average of 3 metres. Have I understood that correctly?
No, that's how I read it, yes.
Yep, okay, thank you. And so with that, reading and understanding, what certainty do you have as a planner that there will be this approach and this wording will achieve the objectives of PC1, the restoration and protection of the health and well-being of the Waikato and Waikato rivers? What certainty do you have as a planner?
It's a difficult question to ask because you need to understand impact of each marginal metre, if you like, on the achievement of the objectives. We don't have that level of detailed information, as I understand it. In terms of the 1 metre averaging issue, my own view is if that has become the normal, then I think it's become accepted position. There's probably need for some guidance around how that would be applied. I also wonder about how that interfaces, and I haven't thought about this, so I'm going to raise how that interfaces with the requirements under the regulations, which require a 3 million setback for a new fence without physically closing the hospital. So there's a possibility of years to think about that.
So you haven't really thought about it yet. Do you support these provisions?
Well, like I said, I've supported the provisions that were in scope of the units that I've here, which didn't include commentary on setbacks. So things that I support are the move to 10 metres in the mandatory, and therefore the mandatory stop exclusion of all streams, federals below the 10 metres, 10 degree threshold, and mandatory for all unused water in the streams above the 10 metres threshold, with a discretion around how much water you go for incidents using the processes that we discussed for so far. I do propose that. I haven't taken a position on setback.
So just on picking up on the discretion you referred to earlier on, the discretion of course of the state plan, you attended the planning conferencing?
Yes, I did. Well, I did, but I wasn't there for all the time.
Do you have a copy of the planning JWS for you? It's a full protocol. And if you can go through page 34 of the document, well, actually, you're going to question 27, which starts at page 33. And in there, that question refers to Schedule C, and then it sets out the proposed wording that was put forward by the council at that time. And then it goes on, and it's got some similar wording there, although that deals with slope, to what's now being proposed for the exclusions. And then it sets out the rest of the wording as per the post-conferencing version. But then we go to the matters of agreement, and on page 35 at the top, it says, there are fundamental disagreements with the structure of the rule, uncertainty as a permitted activity, and then GWCF, so that's you, GW, as well as Ms. Ma, I think Ms. Rademacher, Ms. Bruff, and Ms. Kissick, are concerned that the permitted activity rules need to provide clear requirements and not leave excessive discretion to the farm supervisor. So you mentioned in a question to my friend Mr. Conway that one of the distinctions or differences between the version that was filed, put forward yesterday and the council version is that the version put forward yesterday provides a bit more discretion. And so I'm sure and a bit confused, I guess, that in the joint witness statement you were concerned about there being too much discretion in the version that the council's put forward, yet the version that came yesterday offers even more discretion. But you are okay with that?
No, I don't believe that's an accurate analysis.
Oh, please clarify.
I think we're required this discretion, that over the threshold, there was 100% discretion under the council's version, which is the one that we were trying to express, it's quite a concern about. So what I understand it's been done with the rules set out yesterday, or the schedule set out yesterday, is that we've limited that discretion because it is now a mandatory stop exclusion for those funding commitment streams above the slope threshold. So that's what I mean. But my mind, that is limited discretion for the supervisor. Because they now can no longer say, well, we can do something, you don't need to stop exclude those streams, you can do something else. So I think it's the least discretion. Apologies if I misspoke, but my view is there's less discretion over this later version than there was in the early version.
And so we'll just go back to those minimum standards and the proposed widths. If you have to accept that far less than what the Director General was thinking.
Yes, the widths are now, yes.
And do you think that it's even less stringent than the stock regulations?
As I said, there's one issue here which will need a bit of thought, I think, in terms of that ability to go to one. I accept the fact that there may be need to fix the long farm in a practical sense, so that it will be beyond a sort of low three in some cases. But it's
So some another aspect you haven't talked through yet, you support to an extent this version.
Well, like I said, my support is the fundamental aspects of this that's relevant to the version that I put forward, which is the scope issue, the value discretion issue, and the amusement issue. I support the other aspects of this proposal. I'd say it's somewhat neutral because I just haven't engaged in doing it. I accept the evidence of the environment conservation on those matters. Either is better, but as I said, there are other matters to consider.
And so just looking at you picking up on the practicalities, and you know, the Director General is alert to that issue, and as I advocated that in legal submissions, but it's also the Director General's concern around the lack of setbacks, or the smaller widths and the effects that will have, or rather how that's going to protect and restore water bodies within this region, particularly given Te Ture Whānau. And so with that practicality, what requirement or reference is there to the outcomes of stock exclusions as set out in the policy? Was that factored into the practicality part of that burden? Do you know?
Sorry,
can you repeat that? So the wording there is around, is not practicable, again, in which case setbacks shall be a minimum of 1 metre. So I'm just picking up on the impracticable. And I'm just wondering, when that wording was considered, I'm assuming you've had a hand in drafting this wording as a planner for Fonterra, to what extent did the outcomes of stock exclusion factor into that? So that outcomes of stock exclusion is set out in policy 2, for example. Should we go there?
I'm trying to follow that question.
Sorry, how can I clarify the question?
You asking how do I take into account the outcomes of stock exclusion?
Yeah, and to the wording there, particularly around the wording of practice.
Well, as I say, to the extent I did agree and endorse this particular part of the role, I was conscious that being on farm, many farms and looking at these sorts of issues, there are situations where you might have a meandering stream and you have a straight piece down. If you went like this, it would take you forever and cost you twice as much. If you put a straight line, you might get wider in some areas, but slightly narrower in others, but you get a straight line. Those sorts of practicality things seem to me as being not unreasonable to affect. But I agree there needs to be some limitation around that. I don't think I wouldn't want to see that kind of flexibility used anyway, but I can also see that on farm, some of those things would make quite a difference to the cost that's going to have to be bought.
You just mentioned you wouldn't want to see those practicalities abused in any way. In what way could that happen, being abused?
Oh, just in the way an average is calculated and what's taken into account. It's an average that needs to be maintained, as I understand it. So, you could foresee situations where there's a large set that because of a bit of bush fence or something, and then that was used to average out an hour and a 1 metre set that to be okay over a long period, over a long period. That would be, in my view, not what I would anticipate being a proper use of this rule. And that's why I mentioned before, possibly some guidance from the council around how that discretion to be exercised would be useful.
A discretion of the witness statement you were concerned about?
The discretion I was concerned about the witness statement was not related to that so much. It was related to the issue that no further fencing is necessary. We think that good fencing might be practical.
Thank you. And so,
would now be a convenient time to take a break.
Yes.
That's all right. Thank you. Well, as you understand the rules,